These are the Target Files, discussing the novelizations and audiobooks of classic and now also new series Doctor Who stories, looking through the eyes of adulthood at our childhood memories. After all, a great Time Lord once said, "There's no point in being grown up if you can't be childish some of the time."
Hello and welcome to episode 93 of the Doctor Who Target Files. I'm your host Lee, here with my co-host
Mike. Hello faithful and new listeners.
And this week we will be discussing the Ian Martyr story, The Invasion.
And the audiobook performed by Patrick's son David. Yeah, so initial thoughts, Lee?
I love this. I really did love this. This TARDIS team is my favourite TARDIS team. I think Pat and Jamie work so well together, and in this story David does do his father justice, because I'll be honest with you, I listened to this audiobook twice, because the first time I was so busy thinking, is that Pat talking? Are they just taking his audio? He gets his voice spot on. Pat Troughton, I've always felt, has one of those voices that's very hard to mimic. With Tom, you can understand why people can do him so well. He's got such a distinctive voice. Pat, though, doesn't. But David gets it just right. He gets Jamie just right. Obviously, with Zoe, he can't do a female voice, but he gets the cadence of the way she speaks. Perfect. What did you think?
He's really authoritative, isn't he? I think his other son, Michael's done a few audiobooks, and he doesn't quite have the same sort of, well, I just said authoritativeness, really. I suppose me and you know Michael as a bit more whiny from The New Statesman when he played, supposed to be Rick Mayall's best mate, but he was he's the one who was bullied by Alan Bastard, wasn't he?
He was basically the slimy sidekick.
Yes, yeah.
Not taking anything away from me, he plays that character very well. But also, when it translates to anything else, especially if you live in the UK and you know you're of our age, that's what you'll always remember him from.
And perhaps, you know, David hasn't had that standout character in his career. More of a sort of character-based actor. Yeah, he just pulls his dad off.
Sorry. Wait, one second. That's somebody else's podcast, that is.
Yeah, so you won't go there, thankfully.
Yeah.
I'm leaving that in. But he does his dad's voice really well.
How did you find the translation from the televised to the pages? Because I know there are some differences in the book that aren't in the TV show, such as when I heard this, I thought Mary Whitehouse would have had a field day if you'd heard Packer calling the Doctor a bastard.
I think that was brought in because of the gap. You know, sensibilities had changed a bit by the 80s when the book came out, so they decided to add that in. And it adds a certain deal more menace to the scene, I think. But as you said, the TV version, Ian Martyr's just got the skill of adding certain elements, whether it's making it more sort of violent, more sort of visceral, or adding that extra line in for that little bit of humour, or that just that little bit extra exposition.
I mean, I know the book was originally published in October of 85, so it'd been a good 17 years since the episode had actually aired.
Yes.
One thing I found with this book, which was different to other books, it wasn't dated. I was listening to this and thinking, this could have been written now. This episode could have written now. What was the name of the electronics company?
Vaughan Industries, was it?
Intel Max or something like that.
Global, something global.
Yeah, that, I mean, that could just be like an allegory for... Yes. Allegory, is that the right word? For Microsoft.
Easily. Apple,
yeah.
Anything.
Yeah. It didn't date. You could listen to that at any time, whereas a lot of, some of the Target novels, it's like, it's of its time. I'm not saying that that's not good, but I like something that's ageless, where you could go, I don't know when this was written.
Yeah, Ian Marta definitely brings something different. Terence Dix has his moments because he's written the most of the range. We haven't done a Malcolm Hulk yet on this podcast, which is strange because we're nearly 100 episodes in.
Yeah.
But maybe next time there's a Pertwee one we can do,
mm.
which is a pretty pretty famously remembered one. To me, so far in this range, I think Ian Marta has definitely stood out, along with Robert Holmes, who, sadly due to illness and being so busy, passing away not long after, only did the Two Doctors, but that's another very sort of different one in its approach.
Ian Marta has translated Derek Sherwin's script, which was based on a story by Kit Pedler.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I always think sounds like a drug dealer.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. Kit Pedler.
Yeah. So I thought that was really interesting. This was a third generation story, but it was still very as fresh as the original one.
Because I can't remember the way around, but Kit Pedler and Jerry Davis always made up a duo. One of them would always write the scientific stuff, and the other one would sort of refine it into a narrative for Doctor Who. So how do you think the science sort of builds up in this book?
I think the science holds up. It doesn't try and bamboozle you with facts and figures, and it just aids the story along. You don't sit there going, I don't know what that means. You don't have to know what that means.
The build-up of the story, I found, the menace was kept in the background for quite a few episodes on TV and quite a while in the book. Do you think that worked as the slow burn?
In the audiobook, the menace doesn't come in until about an hour and a half. The audiobook is only about 4 hours long. They've really left until the middle. You don't know what is really going on. All you know that Packer, this story is the first time we ever see a unit.
That's true, and the brig has gone up from Colonel in the Web of Fear to Brigadier now.
Yes.
And you see Benton as well, but they're very much in the early stages. I think by the time of the Pertwee era, certainly after the first season, they become the caricatures that we know now.
And another reason why I had to go back and listen to this was, when I was obviously making notes for this episode, it said, audiobook read by Nicholas Briggs and David Troughton. And I had to go back and think, I don't remember hearing Nicholas Briggs speaking. Did I miss something? But is there another audiobook?
No. He's the voice of the Cyberman. And the Daleks in the new series. And they've got him to do the audiobooks of the old ones. So he does the Dalek voices when you hear them in an audiobook, and the Cybermen ones. Which can be a bit controversial because, you know, most people do think he's excellent, as I do, in the TV show.
Yeah.
But a lot of people, older fans, see it as a bit sacred, you know, taking the old voices. But what can you do, really? Because he's the one who basically, I think, built his own ring modulator, which gives the, obviously, yeah, gives the sound he wants.
I mean, it would be a great idea if we could always, you know, we could keep our heroes and everything alive and well. But people die. People move on. You have to accept new things. I mean, look at fandom in general.
Yeah.
People, even now with the new Star Wars trailer coming out, you've had people go, no, it's not like the originals. Well, no, it's not like the originals.
It's not going to be, is it? No.
Which we'll talk about later.
Character-wise, Tobias Vaughan. There's a sort of big reveal. Should we spoil it towards the end? He's a little bit like what you reminded me of was Ash in Alien, the first one.
Yeah, I can see that.
Do you think that was a sort of a step too far? It made sort of sense because did it give it a different element? Because a lot of the time in that era of Doctor Who, and as the classic series went on, you would have this one sort of pure villainous human being.
Yeah.
But as it's proved not to be the case, he's not totally human, shall we say?
Yeah.
Do you think that worked in the context of this story?
Yeah, I think it did. And he came across as genuinely creepy, especially when he's trying to control everyone. I think the characterization of the villains in this were really good. They weren't one-dimensional by any means. And you just sort of love, as the story went on, you just loved to hate him. Packer was slimy.
Yeah.
And he was supposed to be slimy.
Yeah.
It's very different. I thought it was very different to how he was portrayed in the TV show. But I suppose when you're the only person doing the voices, you have complete control of how everyone sounds.
Yes, that's very true.
You are both director and performer in the same yeah. at once.
One thing I felt the audiobook missed out on was the TV music soundtrack. I really enjoyed that, you know, the, the 60s sort of vibe, almost the spy film vibe, wasn't it, with the clanging guitars and the...
Funny you should say that. I know, slightly going off to the televised versions, I know unless they find the missing episodes, the only way we're ever going to see this is how it is now.
Yes.
With the animated versions and the original episodes. I disagree in... animation, so I should have loved them. I think they've done really well, but because they've been directed by a 21st century director, you are missing that 60s vibe to them.
Yes.
He has these close-ups, he has these long shots where, considering it was filmed in a very small studio, and it had that graininess to the each episode, when you see it as the animated version, it goes from this very clean version to this gritty and grimy version, and I don't think they mash up very well.
That does jar, you know. I sort of, because I'd watched this years ago when it first came out, it did jar then. I think the second time I was ready for it to watch it this time, and I sort of didn't notice it as much, but as you said, the brightness does stick out.
I mean, that's one, I know you went with someone to see The Power of the Daleks, didn't you? When that was... No, I've only ever heard that as an audiobook. Well, not audiobook, audio dramatisation of the original episodes. I'm never going to watch that unless they find the original episodes, because I can imagine how it would look. I can imagine how it was filmed and everything like that. I don't want to see it as bright. I know even though it's black and white, it's still very bright white, very bright greys.
Yes.
And the black, you know, there's this massive contrast of colour where it's, you don't, it all blends into one with the original episode because of the camera quality that they had. It was filmed on videotape, not film. Yeah, and it was filmed on videotape, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have been.
Film in 66, yeah.
So that's one thing I don't like about the TV show.
When I watched it at the BFI, I went over the top with praise for it. But I do remember watching the Telesnaps version by the company Loose Cannon, which were a fan-made company, who took the Telesnaps. Obviously, they took pictures on set at the time, played the soundtrack over it, and put the odd descriptive text flowing down the bottom of the screen.
I think they
that actually, me, worked better than an animation in that case, because as you said, it's very bright. They've done it through the 21st century lens.
I mean, there's a film called... The only time I've ever seen something like that, there's a film called... London After Midnight, starring Lon Chaney. And the last known print of that got burnt in the 60s, so there is no version of it now. So I think it was Turner News, you know, TNT, they did a version of it using the snaps from the set and just put the dialogue over it. And that works. And I think that can work with the missing episodes. I know you can't do it for every missing episode.
But the thinking is people won't watch, you know, Telesnaps. They want something moving visually. That's the thinking. They won't be able to market Telesnaps.
I mean, I can understand, obviously, they want to make money. I mean, as much as they're doing this for the fans, they're also doing it to make money so they can continue on to make the show.
Because I haven't got the Macquarie yet. It's been out a few weeks.
Actually, I was going to text you about that on Friday, because I was in Saturday. I was in HMV and I saw it, and I was like, I wonder if Mike has watched this yet.
No, I haven't yet, no.
All right.
I bought The Power of the Daleks. They showed the first three in that preview. There was three more episodes, a six-parter, and I bought them all on iTunes and they're still there. You know, I watched them maybe once.
Yeah. I mean, I did that with the famous Sharda. I watched that and I've only ever watched it once. I don't think I'm ever probably going to watch it again. So, have you got anything else to say about...
I think we've been through a lot of it, really. We mentioned the fear of technology at the beginning. That's one of the themes, isn't it? Would you call Tobias Vaughan a bit of a sort of a fascist, the way he treats people? Or
I think in science fiction, the villain is always a fascist.
Yeah.
It's almost a staple now. If you made them... a socialist, people just wouldn't buy it. No, he has to be a fascist.
Although they did that with an episode in the warehouse in Jodie's series, Kablam. He was sort of the freedom fighter, was the one behind it all.
I'm going to admit something terrible. I've still not watched all of Jodie's season. Not because I didn't like her, I just haven't got around to it. They're all sitting on iTunes waiting for me to download them.
Busy man.
Yep.
Father to a young child, busy man.
Yes, and way too much good TV. I think it's going to be the next thing on my list to get through.
A few nice touches by Ian Marta. He called the Russian bass Nick Courtney, which is based on Nick Courtney, who played the Brigadier.
Yeah.
So that was nice. Actually mentioned by Nick. There's a documentary about Ian Marta's Target Box on one of the DVDs. I think it's actually called On Target. Remember that name?
Yes.
With Ian Marta. And sadly, he died. Forgot to take diabetic medication, I think, in 1986, and died of a heart attack around about our age now, mate. So.
Wow.
Pretty scary thought, but the feeling is he would have totally embraced the new adventures and Big Finish, and he probably would have been, had he lived much longer, you know, right into this day, he probably would have written original Doctor Who novels, he probably would have done more Target adaptations.
Would you have liked to have seen him come back and write for the new series?
Yes, and appear. It would have been good to see him appear as Harry again with Sarah. Sadly, Liz is gone now as well.
As time's going on, you're having less and less from the classic series that could possibly appear. Isn't Sarah Jane and... Because how many from the classic series have actually been in the new series? Is it just Elizabeth Sladen and Katie Manning?
Yeah, you know, Katie Manning was the Sarah Jane Adventures. Yeah, but she appeared with Matt's Doctor. That's it, I think. And the Brigadier appeared in the second series of the Sarah Jane Adventures.
Why do I have a memory? I think with this sort of Mandela effect of... I thought he was in the new series as well.
They were planning to do it, but his... His health wasn't too great by then, and obviously he sadly went then about 2011. Same year as Liz, actually, you know, so...
That was a bad year for Doctor Who.
It was. One thing, can I just mention one scene in the TV version, which is a brilliant juxtaposition. Not everyone notices it because of the 60s framing, and it's in black and white. But when Pat is being chased down the alleyway and he's doing this sort of funny jump between explosions, do you remember that?
Yeah.
Towards the end of the episode. It's actually a bit jarring because at the very top of the scene when he's run up the stairs, you actually see the corpse of Tobias Vaughan hanging over the barrier.
Really?
Swinging back and forth, yeah. And I hadn't noticed that until someone pointed it out on Twitter a few years ago. And when you go back and watch it now, it's quite a comic scene with Pat jumping around. But then you see this corpse sort of swinging at the very top of the scene and the stairs in the factory.
I think we're going to have to go back and watch that tonight.
Yeah.
I want to see
find
that.
Find it, the scene in the last episode, episode 8.
It's one of those things, though, until you notice something and you watch it again, you just can't help. The Stormtrooper bumping his head on the door in A New Hope. It's every time now. Yep, there he goes.
Can I just say one line I loved from Ian Marta? When he describes things, he's talking about the Doctor, I think, in the first scene in the TARDIS console, and he said he was like a crazed concert pianist at the console. He's got a nice little turn of phrase like that, hasn't he? And that sort of can elevate it, and that's why you have these Target books.
Now that you've said that, one thing that I really loved, which you didn't even have to see, of how well this was written, when they're describing being in the canoe, and he says that Jamie's busy paddling.
Yeah.
And then every so often he looks over to the Doctor, getting annoyed, and the Doctor pretending that he's actually doing something.
Yeah.
It was so well written, you could imagine Fraser Hines and Pat Troughton being exactly like that.
Yeah.
I remember listening to an interview with Fraser Hines of just saying how good of friends they were. They didn't even have to say anything to one another.
No.
They knew what the other one was thinking.
Yeah. And they used to drop Deborah, who died last year, Deborah Watlin.
Yeah.
They used to drop her in it because her dad was in the Abominable Snowman, I think. And they were up in the hills of Snowdonia in the middle of winter filming it. So Pat had a hip flask on him with whiskey. And he'd be giving it to Deborah, you know. She was only just of an age to drink, and they'd be grassing her up to her old man, you know. They were a right pair of so-and-sos like that.
Was it Deborah that they, when they got all of the foam onto the water, that they grabbed her and just threw her into it?
Was that Fury from the Deep? The story, maybe? I've heard the story, but I can't think which one it is with foam.
I think because the production crew had spent for a really long time to get it all done.
Yeah.
And Fraser Hines tells a story of Pat looking at him looking at Pat, and then just grabbing her and just throwing her into
laughing,
it.
Laughing, yeah. Yeah, no, they did seem a right good pair.
Yeah.
But, you know, let us know which story that's from, folks, at DW Target Files on Twitter, at Doctor Who The Target on Instagram. And we're moving into the 21st century by having a Hotmail address soon as well, but I haven't set it up.
Ah, nice. I didn't know anything about that.
No, I'll give you the password. Okay, Lee, covers Andrew Skeletor, as you said, mid-80s release. What do you make of that first one? Well within the range, I think.
It's a Doctor Who Target novel. It looks like one. It tells you exactly what it's about. I really enjoyed this one. I liked it. It's the same cover as the audiobook.
Yeah, sort of Doctor Who, would you say orange Davison logo with a white trim? Yeah, the invasion underneath. doesn't show the Doctor. People sort of have had issues with that in the past, which Doctor it is. And it does show the Cybermen, which sort of slightly goes against the slow build-up we were praising in the novel. But it's just so well drawn, isn't it? And that's definitely my favourite type of Cyberman face.
I think that is still my... I don't particularly like the new Cyberman, I'll be honest with you.
Me neither.
Especially now, they just look like Iron Man Cyberman. I know it gives it away that it is the slow build for who it's actually invading. But for me, if I saw this and I hadn't read it, I hadn't heard it or seen it, I would go, oh, it's going to be a Cyberman invasion. I'd be hooked. I'd be ready to watch this. What about the 1993 re-release Virgin cover?
Yeah, can I just mention the unit sort of looks sort of a bit decayed, almost browny orange, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Badge. And that works pretty well. We'll just take a look at the 1990s one. Alistair Pearson this time. Does it remind you, or do either of these remind you of any sort of comic book artists? You're a big fan of those?
I suppose
it's more impressionist than comic book, really,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's
style.
I mean, I know you have Alex Ross that does in a style like that, but I think he would still be in short trousers. It's well done, but it doesn't feel like classic Doctor Who. It seems as though it's something that's been knocked up quite quickly.
Is that partly to do with them using the McCoy logo at the time and the ribbon?
Maybe, but just with the purple background. Would you say that was a purple background?
Yeah, sort of purpley blue, isn't it?
And then just showing the Cybermen and the Doctor. Yes, okay, it's saying it's a Pat Troughton story, yeah, and it's got the Cybermen in it, but it doesn't grip you.
No, and the sort of purple, is it meant to be like a wall, a pavement?
A lack of imagination?
Quite possibly. And Pat, you know, he doesn't look too happy to be there.
No.
Bit of a frown, oh dear.
Had Pat died by this point?
If this was a 90s, yeah, then... 87, March 87.
He'd been coal haulings by this point?
Yes, and one of his last roles was Inspector Morse.
Was it?
Yeah. It's the very first, is it the Jericho, the first episode of Inspector Morse? He's like a pervert in it.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll have to look at that.
So which of those would you prefer, mate?
I would stick with the original, the Target release, not the Virgin release.
There's just something about them with the Target symbol as well, isn't there?
It
just feels so right.
There's something quite warm and comforting about the Target covers.
Reassuring.
Yeah. Right, so then, Mike, what are you going to give this story out of 10?
What are we doing now? Are we doing book and audiobook and story anymore?
No, should we just give an overall...
Overall score. All the elements. Yeah, Marta's really added to the TV story, I feel. It misses out a bit on the TV soundtrack, but they've done a decent soundscape. Sometimes they can go overboard with the more recent releases, but this is 2016. The use of Nicholas Briggs I can accept in getting a modern audience in. As you mentioned earlier on, we're not going to get the old voice actors back. So I would say round it up to about maybe 8.5 out of 10 overall.
This story was enjoyable. I didn't get bored by it at any point. Like I said, I was distracted by David Troughton's speaking just because I thought he was his dad. But that's down to me, not down to the story. Yep, I'd give this a solid 8. And again, it's Pat Troughton, it's Fraser Hines.
Recommended purchase?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Especially if you don't want to buy the actual hard copy, get it from Audible.
That's right, Audible can be done for $7.99 a month. I got this one through Google Play because it was down to $7.99 as a one-off on Google Play, and I'd already used my credit for something else on Audible.
So then, Mike, what else have you been watching, listening to? What have you been up to in general? Any news?
Yeah, yourself and me went to see the reboot or new version of Hellboy the other night, and gotta say, maybe a little bit too long because I'm finding it a bit frustrating to watch anything over maybe an hour 45 in the cinema nowadays. Although, unless it's relentlessly paced like Infinity War was last year, and I think Endgame will be, I think I'll enjoy that. Pretty solid Hellboy, maybe 7.5 out of 8.
I'm a big fan of Hellboy, and I thought this was a very faithful adaptation to the Mike Mignola comic book. It maybe didn't have the dark gothic feel that the Guillermo del Toro films had, but it had enough of it to make me really enjoy it. And the cameos of Lobster Johnson, and I won't spoil it for anyone that hasn't seen it, but the end credit scene did make me very excited to think, please make a sequel to this. I want to see this film coming to it.
What's the stats? Has it made good money? Because I presume it's out in the States. Everything's out the same day now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's done pretty well.
What's number one at the moment? Shazam, isn't it? Still?
Yeah.
Or is Hellboy close to that? Or
no, Shazam was... That's another film I've also been to see. A very upbeat superhero film. It's very different from other superhero films in the sense of he doesn't see it as an obligation to do. He just loves being a superhero, and that was something I really gravitated towards, something that was really positive. So any other news from you, Mike?
Yes. Well, I managed to grab a ticket for Gallifrey 1. Hooray!
Whey!
The world's biggest Doctor Who convention in LA next February. So really looking forward to that. And Lee himself can't make that one, but he's going to be at New York Comic Con next year, aren't you? So.
Yes, as long as I can get a ticket, I will be going to New York Comic Con
so
again.
So we will have representation at both, more or less. If
yes.
We get some t-shirts done, maybe.
Possibly, and I think also as well, maybe making a little report while we're there. Recording
yeah,
on our
both,
phones.
You know,
I still find that really strange that they do such small conventions in the US.
Yeah.
But when it comes to things like London Film and Comic Con, they don't do them.
There's a bit of a... People like Fraser Hines have said this to me at Regenerations. Americans just seem so more enthusiastic than us. You know, we're quite cynical, a lot of the Brits, aren't we?
Yeah.
Perhaps we ask more sort of leading questions and we're not a positive person.
There's an old Ben Elton joke which talks about service and like fast food restaurants of, you know, Americans. They're built for service. You know, have a nice day.
Yeah.
How's your food? Is everything okay?
Yeah.
But if you put a British teenager in a cap and then make them work in a fast food restaurant, all you've got is a British teenager in a cap. They're no different. They're not happy.
No.
They're just miserable.
They're grunting.
Yeah. I think that's changing though now. I mean, you've got this, especially with the current climate, you've got kids, and I say kids, you know, everyone seems a kid now, and I'm now in my mid-40s, of being very sort of positive and upbeat. You see that in the comic conventions, which kind of annoys me. That's just because I'm old and grumpy.
True, you know, we were sort of a bit more guarded. We were a bit more stiff upper lip, I suppose, weren't we?
Yeah.
Just kind of a bit miserable and... Strange how it's gone. It has become very sort of... I'd say the UK has become more and more like the film version of America. I mean, as we said, we know people who've gone to America and been very disappointed that it isn't like a movie. Mm. Whereas we've known that for years.
Although, one thing I will say about... You know, I've been to America quite a few times, and one thing I will say about that is when you watch British films, it sounds like a very exaggerated version of the way British people talk.
Yeah.
When you watch American films and then go to America, you realise that's exactly how they talk.
One thing I've rewatched recently is the Austin Powers trilogy. And he's driving through the countryside in that, and he says, doesn't the British countryside look a lot like Los Angeles?
Yes.
And they are brilliant. Go back and watch them, folks. Gold Member, I think we chatted, is probably still the third one is the best, which is unusual for a trilogy. But that's available with Amazon Prime membership at the moment, but I just found it brilliant to watch again. And it got me thinking, Mike Myers has talked about doing a fourth one, you know, is there too much time now? But I think the hook you could have in it is you could have Austin Powers having a son who's a bit more sort of hard-nosed, like a parody of the Daniel Craig Bond.
Yeah,
I suppose they could have that conflict there. Because you could have to have Scott Evil now, wouldn't you? As they get on as brothers now towards the end. And I always forget the first film, Carrie Fisher plays a therapist.
That was a lovely little link then to, obviously, this weekend, it's Star Wars Celebration, where you have all the Star Wars news. And the big one this weekend was Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. What did you think of the trailer?
Outstanding. That first shot, that is why you have J.J. Abrams back. The somersault into the... I've got to get the ship name right now, mate. Let me think for a minute. Is it an X-Wing or is it a TIE... TIE fighter? No.
It's a TIE interceptor.
TIE interceptor, that's it, yeah. But apparently the somersault was done for real because somebody I've read on a forum has said that... the stunt woman said, yeah, she did it for real, but obviously... The TIE interceptor wasn't there.
Yeah.
But,
that would have been a hell of a risk going, yeah, you might not live this. Have we got all your shots?
But later on in that trailer in the desert planet, did we see a pod racer as well exploding? Because you see something exploding, don't you?
I also noticed as well that when you see the background, have you ever seen the classic Ralph McQuarrie photo drawing of R2 and 3PO and you've got the desert background?
Yeah, it's very gothic nature, isn't it?
the mountains look very much like that. And what I would love to see in this film is they end it the way it starts, on Tatooine.
Yeah, looking out to Twin Suns.
Yes, looking at, and having them. I know they did it with Revenge of the Sith, with the suns going down, but I would like to see it ending on Tatooine.
You know, part of me did wonder in the trailer whether a lot of it is Rey facing her fears in a sort of planet-wide extension of the cave on Dagobah. But how would that explain Finn and Poe being there, I suppose?
I think we're just going to have to wait to see. I mean, you've already got speculation now, and you've got people breaking down the trailer scene by scene of, oh, did you notice this? Did you notice that?
And did you see Ian McDiarmid came on stage straight after the trailer? And it took him about a minute to get composed because he was down to burst out laughing. And he put the Emperor voice on and he said, "Roll it again."
Do you know the worst thing about that? I had seen you before that and you forgot about watching it, and I watched the entire panel, watched the trailer, then clicked it off, and then you text me saying, "Did you see Ian McDiarmid? What are you on about?" No, I heard him laughing at the end of it.
Down there, and he's dying not to laugh, and he has to wait for the crowd to go quiet, and he just says, "Roll it again."
I'm excited the idea of the Emperor's back. I know you're going to have fans saying, this is ridiculous, you're just putting him in there now for it to echo the Return of the Jedi. I don't care.
Because someone pointed out to me on the Gallifrey Base Star Wars forum last night that Endor, of course, is a forest moon, isn't it? So there is a planet below it. It could be that, where we see the sphere at the end.
Yeah. I'm hoping for Ewoks. I like Ewoks.
Yeah.
I know I'm not one of these people.
But would it have taken out a lot of Ewoks for falling down?
It could have done.
Yeah.
There's lots of people who would be happy by that.
But I'm kind of hoping we see a lot of Force ghosts. If it came down to you, would you rather see Alec Guinness as a Force ghost or Hayden Christensen?
I think for the story-wise, I'd rather see Hayden Christensen. I know a lot of people hated his acting, but let's be honest, those scripts weren't great. And in Revenge of the Sith, I thought he was great. He came across as really menacing. If someone offers you a turd sandwich, there's only so much you can do with it. So it wasn't all down to his bad acting. It was also down to bad direction and bad writing.
Would you like to see them remade ever, the prequels?
No, because I've got a weird love of it.
As time goes on, I prefer The Phantom Menace out of the three the most.
Funny you should say that. Yesterday I sat there and watched the teaser trailer and the trailer for The Phantom Menace again, and just I remembered how excited I was, and then it came out and I was really disappointed. But as you said, as time's gone on, I've really enjoyed that. I really enjoy Revenge of the Sith. Attack of the Clones has got some interesting bits, but Hayden Christensen's bad acting, Ewan McGregor's really bad beard, which is clearly stuck on.
Padme, why aren't you running a mile from this creepy bastard?
Yeah, he just comes across as a creepy stalker.
Yeah.
The S&M bits where she's all dressed in leather, that's weird.
Back onto that trailer. I had a bit of a flashback moment because I tried to play it on the PS4 app through the TV, and the internet connection on the YouTube app must not have been that good, because it came out looking like a VHS copy when the trailer first came up. And literally, the picture quality was like 20 years ago when I had the VHS pirate version of The Phantom Menace. And it was
a pirate version of Get Out.
Sorry. It was doing the rounds here before internet video was more widespread, although I do remember QuickTime on the videos in university in 1999, and that was a bit slow, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, with The Phantom Menace, it came out in June in the UK, whereas it'd been out for almost a month in America. So you were never going to have a Star Wars fan turn around and go, "Oh, I don't want to see a pirate copy, because I want to see it now, I want to see what it's like."
Although I think I only ever watched it once, because those first 20 minutes, which I still think are very good, very exciting, the Trade Federation, slightly racist voices, George on the ship. But then I think I fell asleep on the Tatooine bit until the podcast race and sort of semi-woke up. Probably drunk.
The podcast race.
Fell asleep in the pod race, I should say, and then woke up with the Darth Maul fight at the end. But like I said, it's something about it. It's the one I probably want to go back and watch the most out of those three.
With Phantom Menace, the one bit in that I find the most boring is the podcast race. It just goes on, pod race. It just goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
And then when it got released on DVD, they added the extra lap in, and you're like, "Oh no, I don't want to see another lap of this."
And are we going to find out, like Robot Chicken, if the Emperor ended up on this planet in the trailer, that Jar Jar was behind it all?
Do you not know the whole thing about Darth Jar Jar?
I think I've seen it mentioned, but I haven't read up into it.
There was interviews with Ahmed Best and with George Lucas about Jar Jar's character, basically saying that when you first see Yoda, he comes across as an idiot in Empire Strikes Back, and then you find out he's an incredibly powerful Jedi. I think the original idea was that Jar Jar would come across as this buffoon, and then you actually discover that he is the Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
But because the film did so badly, they decided to divert from that completely, which I would have rather them kept to it.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I suppose it's how you would have made that character dark, I suppose. It would take a very, very accomplished actor. It was a CGI character, but still.
If you go back and watch the Phantom Menace, sort of all of the clues are there, the things that Jar Jar can do. They say that he's a buffoon, but yet when at the battle at the end... The battle droid where he manages to manoeuvre it to shoot them all down, where that's not really slapstick, that's more of going, you know exactly what you're doing.
Yeah. But can we talk about a curse on that film yet? Because, you know, Jake Lloyd has bipolar now and he's had issues with the law, and Ahmed Best was apparently driven to depression and suicidal thoughts. So has that to do with, you know, fandom? Can we put that on fandom?
I'm going to put that completely down to fandom. You can't, especially, say The Last Jedi, for example. I can't remember her name.
Kelly Marie Tran.
Kelly Marie Tran, thank you for reminding me. What did she do to make that film worse? Nothing. She was a relatively unknown actress that was given a big chance to be in a Star Wars movie, and you didn't like her character.
There's far greater issues with that film in terms of the way it's edited. Most of the main players are split up, which is something from the trailer of Episode 9. It seems that the main three are going to be back together for most of it.
You can't blame a film being bad just down to one person, especially if that person has been employed to do a job.
And back onto who? The backlash, purely because she's female, that Jodie is getting. And it is a minority. We all know it's a minority, but they just shout so loudly, that's the thing. They use such expressive language on social media.
Yeah, we'll use Jodie as a prime example. You can't have a woman as a doctor. Why not? I'm sorry to point out to this, fans, I love Doctor Who. It's not real. I know it's not real. And if you want to have a woman, fine. She could be great. She could be awful. But you could have a man that was great or a man that was awful. Colin Baker isn't the greatest doctor. He's been in some episodes that were really good.
Because I'm not going to be here to see it. But would it bother me if the doctors were all female for the rest of my life now? No. If they were the best actresses for the job. Going back to Star Wars, we had Princess Leia. That is a main character. What's the issue? You've had these role models before. Ripley and Alien, you've had these role models before.
Sarah Connor.
Exactly. They're coming up to over 40 years since the first Star Wars.
Yeah. If you take the Terminator franchise, for example, every film that Sarah Connor was in was great. Linda Hamilton, Sarah Connor.
Although we did say we liked the Chronicles TV show with Lena Headey, didn't we?
She was brilliant. She really did take the ball and run with it, where Emilia Clarke, if she'd been standing around talking, it would have been great, but she wasn't. She's not an action star. Those films were great. Sigourney Weaver was always great in Aliens, as you said. Yeah. We've had enough women in science fiction for it to actually be, it's fine. You can have a female doctor.
So, Doctor Who news, folks. Trying to think of too much this week. I know David Tennant and Billy Piper are doing a convention together, Wales Comic Con in Wrexham, North Wales, at the end of this month. Tickets still available, so I recommend going to see those two. Probably not going to be able to afford it myself this year. I was going to be saving for LA next February.
Yeah, I'm not going this year because I'm saving up for Comic Con.
Disney. Speaking of which, Star Trek Discovery. Now, I do like my fan wankery, shall we say. And it's gone quite overboard this season. Spoilers, folks. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Switch off now if you don't want to be spoiled. The latest episode 13, season 2 of Discovery. They recreated the Bridge of the Enterprise. Still not sure if I liked it in the widescreen format. They kept the colours, you know, the red sort of railings, sort of trims around the old display screens. I think Captain Pike, Anson Mount has been outstanding in this season. But perhaps too many old elements at the moment, but a nice setup for the finale this week.
I have still not watched Discovery. The main character, is she even still the main character?
Just about. There's a bit of a tease that she might not be for much longer, but
that would be great. I'll start watching it again. I found that character really irritating, and actually made me turn off.
But she's a much better actress in The Walking Dead. She was very believable, but something about Burnham just isn't that believable for me. I don't know what it is. The writing?
I watched, I think, maybe five episodes and then just thought, this isn't for me. I also, another thing that put me off was the use of bad language in it. Star Trek never had that, and it was always a family-friendly show. It was something that you could watch with the kids, and now all of a sudden it's like, yeah, maybe I'm not going to watch this with my son, because I don't really want him running around going, yeah. I did beep that word out myself.
Were you surprised Hellboy was a 15? Because it was quite... Some of the sort of humour deaths were quite gory. Done in a comic book style, I suppose, but it didn't seem...
I didn't really
It seemed a bit more realistic than because all I really a standard saw
was,
comic book
Because all I saw film. Was Hellboy. I just bought the ticket. I didn't even know what rating it was.
Yeah, it only said 15 at the beginning, and I just thought, oh, well, might be a few swears in this. But has the bar been sort of raised in terms of what they can get away with from us? You know, the first 12 was Batman 30 summers ago in the UK, wasn't it? The first 12 certificate.
I know in the US, the rating system for Revenge of the Sith, you could have actually got F-U-C-K into it, which would have been an interesting thing in a Star Wars movie. But yeah, they seem to be lowering the bar of what you can actually see. I mean, by the time we get to be in our 60s and 70s, you're probably getting hardcore porn on TV.
The C-word in a BBC drama on a Sunday afternoon. Family drama.
Now you say that.
Yeah. Because people were saying, you know how now ITV will go through the Bond films on a Sunday afternoon. At what stage do we get him strangling a man to death in Casino Royale? 2025.
This was before John Hurt had died on Radio 4.
Yeah.
And this was on in the afternoon.
Yeah.
The language in that was incredible. I know it was radio, but still, what you could get away with was incredible. So, I think by the time we're both in our 60s, you will see the James Bond strangling someone to death on a Saturday afternoon, 2 o'clock.
Oh, those are the good old days, you're saying.
Yeah. Good old days when they had TV versions where everything would be beeped out or the words would be changed.
Yeah. Beep. Yeah, and we have the option on our phones to add them in ourselves.
Yeah.
Yippee-ki-yay, Melon Farmer. In Die Hard.
Have you watched Once Upon a Deadpool yet?
No, I haven't yet.
I have watched that, and there's a section in that where it's clearly he's not saying that, but they beeped it out to pretend that he is.
Brilliant.
And it's worth watching just for that scene.
Yeah.
I mean, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed Deadpool 2 anyway. But it is worth seeing it just for them going beep, 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 beep.
Next time we're going to move through the Doctors again and go for Mr. Pertwee.
Let's go for Mr. Pertwee. And I think since I chose a Troughton, you should choose a Pertwee.
Yeah, I think I mentioned the nearly 100 episodes in, we haven't done a Malcolm Hulk book yet.
Yeah, but let's go for that.
Okay, see you next time, faithful listeners.
Bye.
Doctor Who Target Files was hosted by Lee Farncombe and Michael Winks. 13th Doctor theme cover by Borna Matosic. Please do check out YouTube channel BORNA MATOSIC. You can contact Doctor Who Target Files on Twitter at DW Target Files handle or Instagram at Doctor Who The Target. Or leave a message on our Facebook page, Doctor Who, The Target Files. Please do rate and review us on iTunes, and thank you so much for listening.